You are welcome. We are speaking on Thursday, June 25th, 2 days after a Turkish drone strike killed three civilian women near Kobani in northeast Syria, according to Mazlum Kobani, head of the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces, or SDF, which, of course, partnered with the United States in the fight against the Islamic State. A few hours after the deadly drone strike, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo tweeted out his sympathies for the innocent Kurdish civilians killed and for those wounded, presumably because the United States remains partnered with the SDF, even as it is a NATO ally of Turkey. Gunesh, what's going on in northeast Syria? I thought there was a ceasefire in this area. Is Turkey still going after the SDF and looking to move further into these mainly Kurdish areas? And is this causing further instability in the Kurdish enclave known as Rojava?
I mean, I will say that since last October, when the Trump administration decided to give Turkish green light to move to the northern Syria, controlled by the, I would say, but controlled by the PYD, Turkey basically gets some kind of compromise if you look from this perspective, in a sense that Turkish ambitions was much larger than what it ultimately received in October, because they managed to get this, I would say, small enclave, which helped them to have more kind of a pressure point over the rest of the Kurdish areas. But ultimately, the most of the northern Syria is still controlled by the Kurdish forces. I mean, so it's just basically more kind of a, I would say, like a low intensity conflict taking place in the border zone. But as long as the United States remains involved in that area, I don't really anticipate any big changes regarding the Turkish operations. But I mean, yes, in a sense, there will be some drone attacks, there will be a couple of maybe like the armed clashes, but ultimately it will be not the situation like what happened in October, because that was basically more like an extraordinary situation, just like I was 8 months ago.
Okay, just to give us a bit of a framework for our discussion, in an article you wrote last year examining the century-long history of the Kurdish movement, you argued that the three primary strategies of Kurdish nationalism are armed struggle, such as that of the SDF that we mentioned, or the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, in Turkey, which has led an armed insurgency there for decades and is labeled a terrorist group by Turkey, the United States, and the European Union. And then the second strategy is diplomacy and outreach to gain international support and external allies, like perhaps the SDF's partnership with the United States. And then finally, the third is domestic coalitions that embrace democratic ideals and reach beyond the Kurdish community. I wonder if you think it hurts to some extent, hurts the Kurdish cause that it is simultaneously doing all three of these things. I mean, might it not help the People's Democratic Party or HDP in Turkey if the PKK and SDF put down their guns, even though that seems like an impossibility at the moment?
I mean, obviously, it is kind of easier for us to judge their decisions from the safe distance. But I think, I mean, I always think that all these decisions are historical conditions and restraint, in the sense that, I mean, you cannot really switch very easily from one strategy to another strategy without any cost. And if you think about the Kurdish struggle in Turkey, but maybe also in other countries, I mean, for a long time, the international support was out of question. I mean, you can always give the example of the Mohabbat Republic in 1946, when the Soviet Union briefly supported the Iranian Kurds and they established this autonomous enclave. It collapsed in less than a year. Then you can always talk about what happened in the 60s and 70s when Israel and the United States and Iran also supported the Barzani Rebellion in Iraq, which basically failed miserably in 1975. But I mean, you can make an argument that up until 1991, the United Nations Security Council Resolution 688, there was no real international recognition of the Kurdish issue in the world. And if you also think about the last 30 years, that become a main force. So, I mean, obviously in Iraq, I mean, since 1992, but also specifically since 2003, the viability of the Kurdish rule is supported by the international order. And more recently, obviously, since 2000, I would say 2014, not necessarily 2012, but in 2014, since the siege of Kobani in September and October, there is obviously just a very strong involvement of the international community led by the United States in favor of the Kurds. But then, if you come back to Turkey, it's a much more complicated question because, I mean, in both Syria and Iraq, the reason why the Kurds make some gains, well, because the central state either collapsed or they become very weakened because of the internal strife. But you are not going to see the same process in Turkey. So in Turkey, it's a much more difficult process through which the Kurds can actually gain more power and rights. So HDP, HDP, it's obviously represent this cross-ethnic coalition building, which achieved some success in 2015. But then it is also characterized as lots of trade-offs and lots of paradoxes. And I mean, if you want me to elaborate on them, I will be happy to do so.
Yeah, well, let me ask you a question first. In that article from last year, you cite a 2018 report that argued that the HDP has suffered largely because it has been unable to fully disconnect itself from the PKK, which, not surprisingly, undermines its mission of being an agent of democratization. This seems precisely why, just weeks after losing its parliamentary majority in the June 15 parliamentary elections in Turkey, in large part due to the surprise success of the HDP, the Justice and Development Party, or AKP-run government, resumed the kind of violence against the PKK in Turkey's southeast. Please, if you would, tell us a bit about how you see that dynamic, how the HDP is inextricably linked to the PKK, and how the Turkish state uses that to its advantage.
Okay, I mean, I will just give a very brief historical, maybe like an overview, in the sense that, I mean, if you think about the rise of the Kurdish movement in Turkey, at least after the Second World War, it was actually initially more peaceful. I mean, if you think about like the late 60s and also like the early 70s, the Kurdish movement primarily emerged out of the Turkish left. And only by the late 1970s and 80s, especially in the maybe after the military coup of 1980, it became dominated by the PKK, I mean, for the obvious reasons. So in a sense, if you think about what is happening in the maybe last 10 years or so, especially after the emergence of the HDP, you basically see this going back to the roots, in a sense that trying to establish more coalitions with the Turkish left and liberals, but at the same time try to give primacy to the basically to the parliamentary struggle or basically non-violent struggle. But the thing is that obviously, I mean, PKK is a history, is a long history. I mean, it has basically been in around more than 30 years. You can basically say that almost like 40 years. And from this perspective, it is not easy to say that HDP can pursue nonviolence while completely separating itself from the PKK. And I mean, I just make a more like a sociological argument here because, I mean, I studied the PKK for a long time, maybe for like for the last 15 years. And I mean, I can tell you that there are basically tens of thousands of people whose sons, daughters, uncles, brothers, fathers joined the PKK. Many of them get killed. And there is basically a very strong blood relationship between this sociological like a group and then the organization. And then most of these people also established the base of the HDP. So in a sense, I mean, again, like from a maybe more legal perspective, you can always try to make this distinction between the party and the like armed movement. But in reality, from a much more sociological perspective, it is not very easy to do so. And if you are basically one of the HDP leaders, you are well aware of this like this connection. I mean, nowadays, for example, many HDP leaders were accused of supporting terrorism. I mean, in most cases, just because they attended the funeral of a PKK militant. Well, okay. I mean, in a sense, the people, the PKK militants mostly come from the people who are active supporters of the HDP. So from their perspective, it is obviously just like a natural thing to basically attend the funerals of these people. And I mean, for a while, the Turkish state actually tolerated this kind of practices. But obviously, after 2015, it just become like a complete crackdown on the HDP for this and that reasons. But I mean, what I try to say is that it is so difficult to kind of say, that, okay, HDP should basically completely abandon all the connections with the PKK and try to basically establish a much more autonomous position. And I believe that HDP is an autonomous position. But again, from a more sociological perspective, they come as a package in a sense. I mean, there's no way you can basically say that, okay, HDP can need to completely separate itself from the PKK.
Well, that's my question. Is there any way for the HDP or maybe some other future pro-Kurdish Turkish political party to successfully distance itself from the PKK, from Kurdish insurgents and the armed struggle? How might that happen?
I mean, I think there are two obviously possible routes for that to happen. I mean, the first thing which was basically pursued by the Erdogan government between 2012 up until 2015, like late 2012 until summer of 2015, which basically meant that we are going to make a deal with the PKK leadership, and then the PKK is going to abandon the armed struggle, and maybe they will even basically complete disarm, and this will basically bring the end of the violent aspect of Kurdish politics in Turkey. And obviously, we know how it ended up, I mean, for different reasons. The second thing is that, which is maybe what the Turkey is trying to achieve at the moment, completely crack down on the PKK, which basically means that completely defeat the insurgency. And then once the insurgency is defeated, then it may establish a political climate under which the HDP, the more nonviolent aspects of Kurdish politics, became more predominant. I mean, from my perspective, neither of them basically look very realistic. And I mean, we also know what obviously happened in 2015 with that process. But I mean, other than that, like either you defeat the insurgency or you basically make a deal with the insurgency, I can't really understand how the HDP can emerge as the only and relevant party of Kurdish politics with no connection to PKK. I mean, again, so, this doesn't make sense from a political science perspective, if nothing else.
So you would argue that until one of those two things happen, probably the HDP has kind of reached its limit of appeal. It won't go far beyond 10%, 12% maybe?
I mean, you can say that, like, I mean, Turkish politics obviously has been very polarized. So, but then, I mean, we are obviously in the midst of an economic crisis. We are in the midst of a pandemic. So there are more opportunities, more crises happening. So it's hard to say that what will happen in the next couple of years, because I mean, that may lead to a huge realignment in Turkish politics. And I think we see some of the initial symbols, initial signs of it at the moment. But I mean, yes, in a sense, one reason why the HDP cannot go beyond maybe 13-15% up until now is because it's perceived relationship to the PKK by not only by the government supporters, but basically broader segments of the Turkish society, which tend to be highly nationalistic, obviously.
Earlier, you mentioned all the attention that came to the Kurdish cause during Turkey's incursion into northeast Syria late last year. A Kurdish analyst I spoke to around that time, Abdullah Havez, argued that the United States' apparent ending of the alliance with the SDF, kind of betraying them, and the suffering of Syrian Kurds at the hands of Turkish and Turkey-backed Syrian rebels, including reports of ethnic cleansing and roadside killings, all of this brought greater attention to the plight of Kurds and offered an opportunity, he said, for Syrian Kurds in particular, but also for the Kurdish cause more broadly. This, of course, links to the second strategy you mentioned, the international outreach. And during this period, Mazlum Kobane did emerge as something of a global Kurdish voice. That moment, like October, November 2019, seems almost a lifetime away now. But I wonder what you think of that idea that it offered an opportunity for Kurds, and whether now, 8-9 months down the road, you think Syrian Kurds and the Kurdish movement more broadly have begun to cash in on it.
I mean, if we only focus on Turkey, I don't think that it is a very viable strategy. I mean, and I will give two reasons for that. I'm thinking about what happened in Turkey in the early 2000s, which maybe also seemed like ancient times, like just think about like the European Union process when Turkey was an aspiring member. And then you can probably talk about maybe the most liberal periods of the entire Turkish Republic from maybe 2002 up until 2009 or 10, depending on how you basically frame this. But ultimately, that was a time when many people thought that, and maybe naively, that the European Union will play a huge role in the resolution of the Kurdish problem in Turkey in a peaceful way. But then obviously after 2011, everything changed and then European Union became irrelevant. And at the moment, it is completely instrumental relationship between Turkey and European Union. It's all about the refugees, if you think about that. So In a sense, the only way, only viable way for Kurdish struggle to maybe make real gains in terms of getting more rights and power is basically establishing or being a part of a broader democratic coalition. I mean, this is basically my perspective, because it is so different from both Syria and Iraq. I mean, yes, international actors play a very important role in both in Syria and Iraq, and there are some limits, as we have seen in what happened in September 2017 referendum in Bashur in Iraq. But ultimately, when it comes to Turkey, it really means that there needs to be some kind of a cross-ethnic coalition which basically pursue democratization, and through democratization, it also basically bring more rights and power to Kurdish people. I mean, I don't really think that the international dynamics will be so decisive in the case of Turkey, unlike both Syria and Iraq.
But I thought that I'd heard, and maybe you disagree with this, that the Kurdish diaspora in both the United States and Europe, in the European Union, had begun to make more of an impact, had a greater presence in the last 4, 5, 8 years. Is that not right?
I mean, I remain skeptical. Yes, I mean, obviously, there's a much larger Kurdish diaspora in Europe, especially in Germany, in United Kingdom, and then in France and some other countries. Mm-hmm. In United States, you can still talk about the Kurdish diaspora more in Nascan sense, but it is mostly Iraqi Kurds, and Kurds from Turkey are still in an absolute minority. But I mean, when it comes to real political decisions, when it comes to geopolitics, I don't really think that the Kurdish diaspora has a very strong power. It may change maybe in the next couple of decades, but at the moment, I just think that it can be easy to exaggerate their influence over how the Western politicians make decisions. And I mean, yes, sure, there's lots of sympathy. I mean, I am in charge of the only Kurdish center in the academic center in North America. So I basically closely follow all these developments. But I never get the impression that the sympathy for Kurdish people in Western circles directly translates into tangible policy decisions. I think there's a big difference between these two.
Right. In that article of yours from last year, you write that the U.S. alliance with the SDF, quote, did not translate into U.S. political support for Kurdish goals for autonomy in Syria. The U.S. continued to portray its relationship with SDF or YPG as temporary and transactional. I wonder, after the SDF played a crucial role in eliminating the ISIS territorial caliphate, and after the U.S. appeared to end its alliance with the SDF, but then kind of realized the value of this alliance and extended the cooperation, I wonder, after all that, is it still the case that the U.S. doesn't support these Kurdish goals in Syria?
I mean, I think my broader point is that when I think about the American foreign policy in the Middle East, specifically regarding Kurdish people, it never gave priority to the Kurdish causes. And what I mean is that, I mean, yes, like under certain circumstances, you can talk about like a strong American support to Kurdish causes. But when it comes to like a trade-off between supporting Kurds on the one hand and basically abandoning some kind of alliance with like a stronger power, and in this case, it will be Turkey, that in most cases, and maybe in all cases, the United States tilted towards the broader actors. So in a sense, if you think about like the Syria, I mean, I'm not in the business of forecasting, but if I might make a more forecast, this is how I basically see the future of the Rojava. I mean, I basically think that the situation in Iraqi Kurdistan from 1992 up until 2003 will basically how the situation in Rojava will look like for the foreseeable future. So you will basically think about some kind of an enclave with some international support. And I think this will basically go beyond what happens in November in this country, whether Trump is defeated or not defeated. I think it will not make a big difference in terms of this policy. But at the same time, when it comes to international recognition, when it comes to something more tangible, it's not going to happen. Yeah, I mean, in a sense, yes, the United States can prevent Turkey from having a full incursion into Kurdish areas in Syria. But at the same time, it doesn't mean that the United States is basically putting lots of pressure on Turkey so that it changes its own Kurdish policy. I think they are two very different things.
That's interesting. As we were talking about this interview over email, you said that U.S. support is essential to the long-term viability of this Kurdish enclave in northeast Syria, Rojava. But you also said that allying with an external power makes it very difficult for the Kurdish movement in Turkey to pursue a sustainable cross-ethnic alliance conducive to democratization, referring to the pro-Kurdish People's Democratic Party, HDP. I wonder if you might explain that a bit. Maybe I misunderstood it. Why does the U.S. SDF alliance make life more difficult for the HDP? One might argue that aligning with the world's most powerful democracy makes the broader Kurdish movement appear more, not less legitimate.
I mean, I will just first make a caveat. The world's like maybe largest democracy, I think it is being more disputed nowadays in this country as American
citizens. sure.
In political circles in this country. But with this caveat aside, I think my broader point is that when we think about the Turkey, I mean, unfortunately, regrettably, Turkey is going through one of the most authoritarian periods of its entire history. But at the same time, when people only focus on the current government and the current president, they are basically, in most cases, missing the broader picture. And the broader picture is that Turkey is obviously based on Turkish nationalism. And I mean, if you ask me what is the most distinguishing aspect of Turkish nationalism for the last century, I will basically tell you that it is basically suspicion and some kind of anxiety regarding the Kurdish issue. So the point is that when you have a situation in which there is a Kurdish party in control of the northern Syria, this obviously creates a huge national anxiety in Turkey. And I'm not saying to justify that, obviously, I'm just making more kind of observation. And this anxiety is not specific to the government circles or it's not specific to the president, which basically means that whenever there's this kind of a connection between the United States and a Kurdish actor, it basically creates more like uncertainty and fear among the Turkish political actors regarding the Kurdish question in Turkey. And this is basically what I mean by that. Just because we have this international support in Syria, it doesn't mean that it's going to help you in Turkey, because in Turkey, I think, coming back to my earlier points, what really matters is basically the ability. And some of this ability is obviously beyond what HDP can do or cannot do, because it also depends on other Turkish political actors, specifically the opposition. But ultimately, it depends on whether we can talk about a viable and sustainable cross-ethnic democratic coalition in the foreseeable future. And the point is that once you basically have this picture, geopolitical picture, in which a Kurdish political actor with close connection to the Kurdish movement in Turkey is being supported by the United States, it basically really kind of, in a sense, aggravates Turkey's maybe traditional nationalistic anxieties, and also basically paved the way for more repressive measures. And again, I'm not saying it to kind of like anyway justify or basically kind of like make it sound like right, but it's just more like an observation. And under the circumstances, it becomes more difficult for Kurdish actors to pursue that kind of coalitions.
You mentioned
because, that. I mean, that just like, to wrap up, you can always say that because then they will be always perceived as like a fifth column, if you want to use this word. Like in a sense, there is this like suspicion, always this fear that they have some kind of alter agenda despite their best intention, despite their best efforts to kind of make a commitment to the Turkish democratization. So this is basically one of the dilemmas, at least from my perspective, confronting the Kurdish movement in Turkey at the moment.
You also write that with the April 2017 approval of the new presidential system in Turkey, it became very difficult for a Kurdish party to have access to executive power, explaining that the new system is less conducive to coalition governments and thus reduces power sharing and essentially locks out Kurdish nationalists to a certain extent. But you also added in that piece last year that the new presidential system could unintentionally lead to a robust political alliance that transcends ethnic divisions and ultimately boosts Turkish democracy. Please explain this perspective, if you would.
I mean, I'm also a quantitatively oriented social scientist with a deep interest in history. And I can tell you that, I mean, I basically look at like all the people who become ministers in Turkey for the last 4 years, all the people who become governors in Turkey and in the Ottoman Empire since 1876. I can tell you that when it comes to political representation or political access to executive power, you see a huge gap in the sense that there is a very low likelihood of anybody being Kurdish occupying an important executive position in Turkey, not only nowadays, but basically throughout the entire Turkish history. And so the point is that in 2015, there was a real chance that the HDP could have become a coalition partner. Think about Davutoğlu government. They didn't have the parliamentary majority. So, I mean, at least on paper, it was possible for them to establish a government with the inclusion of HDP. But it basically did not happen, obviously. So the point is that after the introduction of the presidential system, after a very controversial referendum in April of 2018, that became impossible just because then the power became monopolized. So it basically means that from this
Ganesh. Yep. Sorry, there's something going on with the connection. Are you moving or?
No, I'm just stable.
Okay, now it's okay. It was just a, go back to, please, if you would go back to, I think you said, but it, obviously it didn't happen. I didn't hear anything you said after that.
Yeah, so it didn't happen. I mean, yes, because I think one reason is that the MHP, which is obviously the ultra-nationalist party in Turkey, I think their biggest fear is that Kurdish people or Kurdish nationalists basically occupying ministerial positions. It is one thing for a Kurdish activist to become member of parliament. It is a completely different situation if a Kurdish activist become like a minister of a minister. So I think this is one reason why obviously MHP supported the Erdogan's presidential ambitions back in 2018, and they still obviously support him. So from this perspective, it became almost impossible for Kurdish activists or Kurdish basically politicians to become members of the cabinet. But at the same time, just because the system becomes so polarized, it creates greater incentives for opposition forces to try to basically recruit the help of the Kurdish movement so that it can basically get more than 50% of the vote and basically defeat the ruling coalition. So this is kind of more like a silver lining from my perspective. And the point is that it still gives some kind of opening for Kurdish movement to become a key maker in Turkish politics, even if they can no longer become part of the cabinet after what happened in 2018.
Turning back to the Kurdish enclave in northeast Syria, Rojava has for years, as I'm sure you're well aware, been held up by liberal-minded observers, let's say, as a model of democracy. It stresses gender equality and ethnic pluralism and is run effectively by these local democratic councils. Yet there have also been reports, including by Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, of arbitrary arrests and detainment and questionable trials. Journalists and writers have been arrested and abused, and Kurdish parties that oppose PYD rule complain of an authoritarian system that sounds to me a lot like the way Turkey's AKP government.
Just be very blunt. I am a little bit like cynical about this, maybe more romantic images of the Rojava as being some kind of a utopian secular democracy in the middle of a very violent and Islamist Middle East. I think that mostly reflects how people want to think about the secularism and democracy from a Western perspective than anything else. But at the same time, I mean, just from a more contextual perspective, I mean, we are talking about Syria, which is characterized by extreme levels of human rights violations, hundreds of thousands of people getting killed in a very vicious civil war, which is devastating countries since 2011. And we're even talking about chemical weapons attacks. And from this perspective, I mean, Rojava, I don't think that it's basically a democratic system. It is more like a one-party system. But at the same time, yes, you can basically talk about more basic security. You can basically talk about more gender equality for sure. You can basically talk about relatively in terms of like the civil rights that are more established in Rojava than any other part of Syria. I think it is important to kind of keep this contextualization when we talk about the situation. Because I mean, if you think about like even the most democratic systems in Europe or in North America, I think there are lots of problems. So, I mean, I think it's important not to romanticize this kind of a system, especially when you talk about like a situation in which there's an ongoing war. But when you take a more contextualizing approach, I think you can, I think, still identify some very important positive characteristics. So this will be my take on this question.
Okay, and how have Turkish pressures and the current Turkish-controlled buffer area shaped the Rojava project? And how might the international community do more to strengthen it and make it more secure, stable, and democratic? Or is it just kind of its days are numbered? It's only going to last a certain amount of time, and there isn't much we can do to save it or make it greater or stronger.
Some people remain very skeptical about the viability, but I mean, again, just coming back to my earlier point, it really depends on the American foreign policy for the foreseeable future. So if the United States continues its own position, regardless of what happens in November elections, then I think we can still talk about Rojava for the next few or maybe even longer years. But I mean, even from Turkish perspective, it is wanting to capture areas with a more like a non-Kurdish majority population. And it is a complete different situation in which when you want to go and basically completely establish your rule over a majority Kurdish areas in Syria. And I don't think that that is very viable even on the part of Turkey, despite its ambitions. And I also don't think that the Syrian government, given its current shape, is in any kind of position to really recapture these areas from the PYD. So it's kind of almost like a modus vivendi, like from this perspective. I mean, yes, neither Turkey nor Syria are very happy with the situation. But at the same time, I think from a more realistic
Shoot,
perspective.
shoot, shoot. Can you hear me? It's happening again. Yeah,
Oh, okay, sorry.
you're really just going out. I don't know what happens. Can you talk?
Yes, so where did you lose me?
Yeah, I don't know this straight. Okay, so the last thing I heard was I don't think Turkey will be able to recapture these areas.
Yes, I mean, yeah, because ultimately, I mean, how are you going to rule these areas from the Turkish perspective? I mean, if you are basically talk about a very well-organized force with a very strong support among the local population, if you want to defeat the force, maybe you can do that. But in the long run, how are you going to rule that area? I mean, I don't think that that looks very viable and feasible, even from a Turkish perspective. I mean, one analogy I have always in mind is basically what happened in southern Lebanon when Israel occupied the area from 82 up until almost 2000. And they had lots of problems and they basically realized that it's not going to work out. So they basically withdrew from the area almost like disgracefully in 2000. So from this perspective, I mean, yes, I mean, no, neither Turkey nor Syria are very happy with what's happening in northeastern Syria. But at the same time, I don't think that they are in a position to really impose their will over that geography at the moment. So, I mean, again, my position is that whatever we are observing in Syria or Rojava in northeastern Syria is going to be like that for the foreseeable future, unless there's a huge and dramatic shift in American foreign policy, which I don't really anticipate.
Okay. Any last thoughts or ideas you might like to share about the Kurdish movement today or how you see it moving into the future?
I mean, I think I tend to see the Kurdish struggles in a more cyclical way. I mean, it just become maybe very easy to say, okay, we are talking about some kind of a transformative moment, or we are talking about the making of history. I mean, I just remember being in Kirkuk on in late September 2017, when people talk about this was the first time when the Kurds become so close to the statehood, just almost 3 years ago. And obviously nothing happens. I mean, they even become worse. So, but then the system still continues. So, I mean, I think at least from this perspective, I tend to take a more cyclical and long-term perspective, which basically means that these struggles is going to continue for a very long time and for the foreseeable future, regardless of what happens with the American foreign policy or regardless of what happens with the Turkish domestic policy. I mean, I don't think that the Kurdish question is going to resolve in any way in none of these countries, maybe during our lifetimes, if I can make a very bold statement like that.
So, I mean, according to that cyclical view, are you basically saying you don't think the Kurdish movement has really made progress in, let's say, Turkey in the last 40 years? The armed struggle, the HDP's advances, none of it has helped its cause kind of in the long term. It's just going to go back and forth?
I mean, no, I'm not saying that the history is stagnant. What I'm trying to say is that, I mean, ultimately, the basic political perspective, it is more about like the Kurdish people being able to rule over themselves. It's basically about the statehood.
Sure. As many, most freedom movements are about, yeah.
Exactly. I mean, yes. I mean, obviously, you can basically say that the PKK no longer pursue that as the main goal and so on. But I mean, again, from a political science perspective, the statehood and the self-determination is the primary goal of the Kurdish movement for a very long time. And I mean, from this perspective, I don't think that that is going to happen for the foreseeable future, mainly because of like the prevailing geopolitical circumstances in the region. And I think the primary example of that was basically what happened in Iraqi Kurdistan in September of 2017.
Okay. Güneş Murat Tezcur of University of Central Florida, thanks so much for talking to us. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure, David. Thank you.